In one word, tell me what the theme of the book of Colossians is. And I'll give you a clue. It's not Jesus, but it is Christ. One word summary. Now, you could say, give me a one word summary of the Bible. Same answer, right? So you can't say that necessarily about every book, although the overall theme of the entire Bible, therefore the overall theme of every book of the Bible is Christ, but the specific theme of the book of Colossians is Christ. And the fact that when you get to Colossians chapter 3, where Paul enters into his very practical, life-changing part of the book of Colossians, the reality that he wants us to understand is that Christ is to have an impact on every part of our life. Christianity is not just some compartment of our life and then we have the other compartments of our life. Christ is to have an overall, overarching influence on every part of our life. And so he goes through this chapter and says, if you give your life to Christ, he'll change you. He'll make a difference. He'll change your old man into a new man. If you will truly give yourself over to him, then that change can come about in your life. He's talked about in this section, just prior to this, how you can put on that new man. And through that new man, you can serve God. You can be at peace with God. And you can and do those things that are pleasing to God. We're going to look in verse 18. This is where we finished last week. And we'll pick up here. And what I want us to see tonight, starting in Colossians 3 and verse 18, is that Christ not only is to have an impact on my life, he's not only to have an impact on the change from who I was to who I ought to be, from the old man to the new man. He not only changes things like what you see earlier in the chapter, verse 5, he not only changes me from being somebody who's an immoral person into being a godly person. He not only changes my life from being somebody who's covetous to somebody who is a servant. He not only changes me in those ways, but Christ, when we begin in verse 18, if Christ is truly the center of our homes, Christ is going to change your family. You will not have the average family. You will not have the run-of-the-mill family. You will not have the normal family today if Christ is at the center of your home. Because your family is going to be different. How many, what are there, 300 million plus people in this nation? How many of the 300 million plus citizens, people, individuals in this nation have Christ as the center of their home? Do you say it's a large majority? Why would you say no? Have you called them and asked them? Have you interviewed them? Why would you say it's not a large majority? Say again. Their works. You can tell something about a person and therefore tell something about a group of persons, people. How many people have Christ as the center of their home? The condition of our nation today is reflective of the fact that Christ is not the center of very many homes today. And as goes the family, so goes the nation. The nation is made up of families. And if the families are not determined to put Christ in the center of their home, then a nation is not going to be concerned at all about the place that Christ has. And so what we're going to see as we go through this section is the emphasis, and I can't remember if I mentioned this 2 weeks ago or not, but the emphasis that the two words "the Lord" have in this section, starting in chapter 3, and it's really throughout even earlier than this. Look at the last two words of verse 16. What are the last two words you have in verse 16? The Lord. Verse 17, he says, whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord. And he carries that thought. The idea that Christ, the gospel of Christ, is to have an effect on everything that we do, it's going to have a effect on our relationships, especially in the home, especially our domestic relationships. So we looked at verse 18 last time. We won't take time to review all of that, but notice that he says, "Wives, submit to your own husbands," not to every husband. Boy, that'd be horrible, wouldn't it? "Wives, submit to your..." Of course, some of you might, you know, want to play multiple choice and choose. But he says, "Submit to your own husbands as is fitting or proper." Where? In the nation? In the culture? What if this said, "Submit to your own husbands as is fitting in the culture"? Well, that'd be interesting, wouldn't it? Could wives then determine how submissive they are based upon the culture that they live in? Yeah. That'd be kind of subjective, wouldn't it? Well, I don't like this culture. I'm going to go move somewhere else. Has nothing to do with the culture. Has nothing to do with the nation you live in. Does this have anything to do with the time that you live in? As is fitting in the first century. Or as is fitting in the 21st century. It's interesting that God says the relationship in the home is not based upon time. It's not based upon culture. It is based upon your relationship with the Lord. If wives want to have a fitting, proper, acceptable relationship with the Lord, then wives must learn to have a fitting, proper, acceptable relationship towards their husband. Now, he reverses that in verse 19. It's not just the responsibility of the wives, it's the responsibility of the husbands. Verse 19, he addresses the husbands. And you will recognize that these verses are very similar to what we read in the twin epistle over in the book of Ephesians, in Ephesians chapter 5. Here he says in verse 19, "Husbands, love your wives." It's interesting that this verse does not mention the Lord. He mentions it in verse 18. Mentions the Lord in verse 20. So it's not that the husbands don't have any relationship with the Lord, but it's interesting, this particular verse doesn't mention the Lord. But he says, "Husbands, love your wives." Doesn't that sound like Ephesians 5 and verse 25? Where God tells the husbands in Ephesians 5, 25, "Husbands, love your wives, even as," you know the rest of that verse? "Even as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her." There's the relationship. There is the connection between a husband's responsibility to his wife and his responsibility to God, to the Lord. Husbands, love. This is not the word for emotions. This is not the word for passion. This is not the word for that would be used of sexuality. This is that Greek word agapao, agape. This is that Greek word that is not tied to one's emotions. It's not tied to how I feel. It's not tied to my inner passions. It's a love that is tied to my relationship with God. And my relationship with God tells me that I am to love my wife. What does that mean? Agape means I put her needs above my own. Agape love means I put her interest above my own. Agape means it is unconditional. It doesn't matter what she does, I'm to love her. It's unconditional. It is unselfish. It's not to see what do I get out of this. Well, she's not doing what I want her to do. She's not doing what I need, so I'm not going to love her. It's unconditional. It is unselfish. And this verb is an imperative. It's not a suggestion. It's not a good idea. It's not a wish that God has. God says to husbands, "Hey, guy, you love your wife as much as Christ loved the church." And then he says, and do not be bitter toward her. Hello? Do not be bitter. Anybody got a different word than bitter? I didn't look at the other translations today. Harsh. Do not be harsh. Do not be bitter. Do not be resentful. Have you been to some homes where they might have, and maybe yours does, where they have some kind of a plaque or some kind of something framed on the inside of the home, and it has three words on it. The first one is home, and the last one is home. You know the word that's in the middle? Home, sour, home. You ever seen one like that? Home, bitter, home. You ever seen one like that? Home, harsh, resentful, mean, rude, ugly, home. You ever seen one like that? What, you haven't seen those words, but have you ever seen that kind of home? Husbands, love your wives and do not be bitter toward them. What is the opposite of sweet water? What's the opposite of bitter water? Can you be sweet and bitter at the same time? I know some of you have tried. Can you successfully, in the eyes of God, be sweet and bitter all at the same time? Can you say sweet words with a bitter tone? You ever tried that? Sweet words with a bitter tone. Bless your heart. You're the ugliest person I've ever seen. Sweet words with a bitter tone. Can you say bitter words with a sweet tone? I hate your guts. Do not be bitter. Is that conditional? What if she does stuff that makes me bitter? Or what if she doesn't do things and that makes me bitter? Is this a suggestion or a wish or an idea that God, is just dreaming that this will be? No. Love your wives. How? Unconditionally, unselfishly, putting her needs above your own. And do not be bitter towards her. How can I do that? I put Christ at the center of my home. I look at the relationship. Ephesians 5 parallels the relationship between Jesus and His church and a husband and his wife. And if Christ is at the center of my home, am I going to be like every other husband out in the world? Am I going to be like the husbands that I see on TV? No. If Christ is at the center of my home, I have Christ as the model husband. He's who I'm trying to be like. That saying enough? We got verse 18, wives. We got verse 19, husbands. We got verse 20. And this might not apply to a lot of folks in here, but is this a verse that we need today? Children, obey. Another imperative. There is an imperative in verse 18, submit. Husbands had two imperatives, two commands. Love and do not be bitter. Both of those are imperatives. By the way, they're both present imperatives, meaning you do it and you keep on doing it. So it's not that, well, I wasn't bitter today, so I get to be bitter tomorrow. No, it's a continual action. Children, obey. Present, continual, imperative. Do it, not a wish or a suggestion. Obey your parents in selective things. You got that? Obey your parents in popular things. Obey your parents in easy things. Obey your parents in what things? Every single one of them. Even the dumb things? Even the stupid rules they make up? Well, I don't like that. My friends don't have that rule. Obey your parents in all things. Why? I sort of like Ephesians chapter 6, don't you? Where it says, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise. You know what the rest of that verse is? It's the first commandment with promise that it may be well with you and that you may live long on the earth. You know what that verse? Flip that verse around. That's the positive side of that verse. I obey my parents, I honor my parents, and it will be well with me and I will live long on the earth. Flip that verse around. What if I don't obey my parents and honor my parents? Who said it? I brought you into this world and I can take you out of it. That you may live long on the earth, that it may be well with you. You don't obey your parents. Is it well with you? Is it possible that some of the things that we are seeing in our culture today, is it possible that some of the this devastating things that we're seeing in our culture today is because we don't have children who learn to obey their parents. We don't have parents who required obedience. If children don't learn to respect authority at home, if children don't learn to respect the authority of mom and dad in the home, what's going to happen when they get to school? They're little darlings? Oh, isn't that sweet? What's going to happen when they go to work? What's going to happen when that police officer pulls them over? Where's the respect? If they don't learn respect and obedience in the home, what's going to happen when they get outside the home? If they don't learn respect and obedience in the home, what's going to happen in their relationship with God? If I grew up with the mentality, I could do whatever I want, I could get away with whatever I wanted at home, guess what my mentality is going to be with if I even believe in God? Yeah, God will let me do that. He won't care. Children, obey your parents in all things. For, come back to verse 20 here. Children, obey your parents, not just in selective things, in all things, for this, the obedience, this is what? It is well-pleasing to your parents, right? It's well-pleasing to your grandparents. It's well-pleasing to your teachers. It's well-pleasing to who? What's the emphasis of this whole section? The Lord. Who is it that children need to be mindful of, even above their parents? The Lord. And that's why Ephesians 6 and verse 1 says, children, obey your parents, next three words, in the Lord. Children not only need to understand the earthly responsibility that they have in obeying their parents, children need to understand the eternal aspect of obeying their parents. For this is well-pleasing to the Lord. Flip that verse around. What if I don't obey my parents? What's the result? In heaven, what's the result? What's the opposite of being well-pleasing to the Lord? Is it possible that the Lord could be disappointed with us? As you think about the reactions that you would like the Lord to have towards you, is disappointment one of them? If you were to stand before the Lord and He were to say to you, David, I am so disappointed in you. I grew up in a home that those were the words I did not want to hear out of my mom or dad's mouth. It would have crushed me if my earthly parents were ever brought to a point because of my behavior where they would have said to me, I am disappointed in you. That would have crushed me. What if the Lord, what if you heard the Lord say that to you? Disappointed in you. Obey your parents. Obey your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing. We've got to see the greater significance. Notice for wives, there's a greater significance than just submission, the earthly relationship to the husband. There's a relationship as is fitting to the Lord. Husbands, you consult the parallel over in Ephesians 5. And the loving your wife and being the head of the wife in Ephesians 5 and verse 23 is not limited to some earthly relationship. It's because of your relationship with the Lord. Children obey their parents, not just because of this earthly relationship, because of their relationship with the Lord. Now, verse 21, he turns to the parents. And I know it says fathers, and sometimes we'll look at this and say, well, it's only talking about the man, the father in the home, and it has nothing to do with the mothers. This has this is being directed to the parents. I know there's some single moms here. We look at this, well, you know, there's not a verse there for me. No, this is a verse for every parent in verse 21. Fathers, do not, another present imperative, another command, present tense, keep on doing it. Do not provoke your children. Anybody have a different word than the word provoke? I know the New American Standard does. Exasperate. Do not provoke your children. I know Ephesians 6 says, in verse 4 says, do not provoke your children to wrath. But notice this doesn't say anything about wrath or anger. It just says, do not provoke your children. Do not exasperate your children. What does that mean? In a practical sense, what does that mean? Don't do to them what they did to you. Seems like Jesus had a verse for that, didn't he? Do unto others as do unto your children. Do unto your children as you would have them do unto you. Do not provoke, exasperate. Do not be one who is overbearing, one who embitters. Don't be one who is who vexes his child. What does that mean in a practical sense? Does that mean you're not allowed to have rules? Child comes home late, missed the curfew, and you punish him. Your child says, don't you provoke me. How's that going to work? Oh, well, I guess I can't have rules and I can't punish my child because if I do, you know, it might provoke them. How do you have rules and consequences for those rules and not provoke your children? Not exasperate your children? How many in here, raise your hand, had or have, depending on where you are in your life, have or had a perfect child? I'll give you a minute. Some of you, maybe you need to process that for a second. The perfect, never did anything wrong ever child. Okay. So, did you ever want to do something to exasperate your child? Did you ever want to do something to get back at your child? If you never had a perfect child, that means you had a child who made mistakes. What would it mean to provoke, to vex, to be overbearing, to exasperate your child who makes mistakes? What would that mean? Would it be demanding perfection when perfection is not possible? Pat? Not raise your child
in the negative way.
Pat says, do not raise your child in the negative, always coming down on them, always pointing out their mistakes. Have you ever had or known of a boss who was like that? Now, I know some of you have bosses in here, so don't be careful now. Don't get certain looks or fingers pointing. But have you ever known or had or heard of bosses who their MO was not to encourage, not to pat on the back, not to point out positive things, not to reassure, not to give encouragement when good is done, but to only point out the mistakes that you make. To only bring up something when you've done something wrong. Does that provoke, exasperate, vex the employee, the worker? If all he does is ride you all the time, telling you where you're making mistakes and where you're doing things wrong, what do you want to do besides find a new job? Does that encourage you to do better? Does that encourage you to step up your game? What does that do to your soul and to your spirit? What does it do? It discourages you. Now, you take that same spirit of that boss and you bring it in the home. No child's ever going to be perfect. Parents' responsibility is to find that balance. And I know I'm preaching to the choir, and I know I'm talking to people who are thinking, man, I'm so glad I'm not raising kids anymore. But for those of us who are trying, parents have to find that balance between having rules and consequences for those rules, because what is the child's responsibility? To obey the rules. Hello? They have to obey, and there have to be consequences, but at the same time, I cannot be one who provokes and exasperates my child. Why? What does the rest of the verse say? Lest they become disheartened, discouraged. If there's a parent who only informs the child of what they're doing wrong, if there's a parent who rides their child so hard to always act a certain, to always go a certain place, to always do a certain, and just rides them and rides them and rides them, is it possible that child can become discouraged? What would be that child's response? What would oftentimes be that child's response? If I'm going to get in trouble anyway, whether I do it right or not, if I'm going to get in trouble anyway, might as well go and do what I want. Might as well go and do what I like, even, you know, because I'm going to get yelled at either way. Somebody else say something? Here's the responsibility: to learn how to have that relationship and to be that parent who doesn't have a child who says, you know, what's the use? I can't please my dad, can't please him to do anything. I don't know if this illustration makes sense to you or not. How many of you have played Tiddlywinks? How many of you have no idea what Tiddlywinks is? All right, that's what I thought. Those of you who played Tiddlywinks, it's been a while. That's been a long while. When you, and I don't even know what the pieces are called now. There's a little disc, little plastic disc that we played. And you pressed down, you used pressure. And you pressed down on, what was that small piece? I can't remember what the pieces are called. But you had a small piece of plastic. And then there were smaller pieces. Am I right about this? It's been so long since I even thought about this. And you pressed down because what you wanted to do is you wanted to flick or flip that piece. Am I right here? Y'all helping me? Man, this is a fuzzy memory. And so you pressed it. Now, if you took your, imagine you're doing with this coins. Maybe that's, for those of you who have no idea. Imagine you have a quarter and you're pressing down on a penny. And you're trying to get that penny to, and I can't remember why we were trying to flip them over there, but you're trying to get that penny to jump over, to flip over, do something. I don't remember what it was. And so if you take your quarter and you press right in the center of the penny, where's that penny going to go? Staying right there. That's the way we want to be parents sometimes, right? You take that thumb, you stay right there and don't you move, right? Press them right down in the center. But here's the deal. As that child grows older, and as that child reaches the point where they're going to move out of the home, we're no longer pressing down in the middle. As in Tiddlywinks, you start pressing down on the edge because they're almost gone. They're at the edge of leaving your home. But if you are still applying that kind of pressure, where you are provoking, exasperating, seeking to point out every wrong they've ever done. When they reach the edge, you take that cord and you're pressing down on the edge of the penny. When they reach the edge and then when they're ready to move out of the home, what's going to happen? They're going to fly. They're going to bust right out of there and they're going to fly off in some other direction. And they don't care to come back. I know there's a fine balance between maintaining obedience and godliness in the home and allowing our children to grow and to develop. But if you are constantly pressing and pressing and pressing and pressing, the time's going to come where that child splits. Where you no longer have any kind of an influence, no longer have any good in their life, and where the Lord is not in their life. And I know we may be talking about situations that you have seen or and maybe you've had different experience than that, and I hope you have. Interesting verse anyway. All right, go to verse 22. Anything you want to say about parents? Yeah. Oh, so Vera had the perfect one. Oh, it was the girl, of course. It was the girl. It wasn't Eric. Eric, her son, he wasn't, but of course it was a girl. All right, we're moving on. We're not going to talk about girls being perfect in this class. Okay. Any other comments about parents? Y'all got to remind me about tiddlywinks too, because that's been a long time. Verse 22, we get to these sections about bondservants, and we think, oh, this has nothing to do with me. Slavery was a reality in the first century. The Roman government had sanctioned and was sanctioning slavery. Christianity comes along, and over time, With Christ becoming the center of individuals' homes, and with Christianity becoming dominant in people's lives, eventually slavery was finally came to its end. But until that time came, God gave some regulations. Again, we're talking about domestic relationships in this section. God gave some regulations even for this relationship. I want us to look at this briefly, but what I want us to remember is that while we may not be in a master-slave relationship today, either being a slave or being a master, in the sense of having slaves or being a slave, as we would think about it even in the previous years of this nation, this has application to the employer-employee relationship. This has application to my responsibility as a employee, my responsibility to my boss. And when you get to chapter 4 and verse 1, the boss's responsibility to his employees. So while we think about this as bond servants and masters, let's think about it in an application of employers, employees. And look at verse 22 where he says, bond servants obey, another imperative. Bond servants obey in how many things? Not select things, in all things, your masters, the ones who are your masters according to the flesh, those who have rule over you in your life, obey. Wouldn't that be hard? Obey them in all things. Now, obviously, and we could go to other passages to talk about this, obviously this is not talking about obeying them in ways that would violate God's will. That law supersedes. And I've got to obey God rather than men when it comes to that. But in all things that are not going to violate God's will, I've got to obey my master according to the flesh. Now, did God know the human heart? Did God know man's the way man would act? He says, now here's what I mean by that. Obey them in all things, not with eye service. I don't know. Does anybody have a different word than the word eye service? Say again. External. Not with the external. Obey them, but don't do it with eye service. Is there a tendency when the boss comes around to do more work. And then when he leaves, all right, we can relax again. Go back to playing solitaire or whatever we're doing. Tiddlywinks, yeah. Go back to going to the computer and Googling Tiddlywinks. I talked about Tiddlywinks in class last night. I got to learn about this game. Not with eyes. Not just when he's looking at you. You obey your master even when he's not looking at you. Even when his eyes are not over you, you do what he tells you to do. Is that easy to do sometimes? Notice, God knew man, and God knew man was going to slack when the boss wasn't around. And God says, don't you, you're a Christian, remember. And he's going to get the word Lord. The end of verse 22 here has the Lord in it. The relationship you have with the Lord is more important than this earth. But your earthly relationship is going to be governed by your heavenly relationship. And if I want to have a right relationship with God, what kind of employee do I need to be? A slacker? What kind of employee do I need? If I am a Christian first, what does that mean? How does that impact the kind of worker I am? I need to be the best employee he's got. I need to be the one who is obeying him even when everybody else isn't. I need to be the one who's doing what's right even when the boss is out of town. Not with eye service, as men pleasers. You're not doing this to get other people to pat you on the back. You're not doing this to get a bonus. You're not doing this to get some kind of congratulations. You're doing it because God told you to do it. And your relationship with God is more important than anything else. Not with eye service as men pleasers, but in sincerity. And the idea there is singleness of heart. You are determined you're going to do this, even if somebody else isn't, in sincerity of heart, fearing, the end of verse 22. What's this all about? It's all about the Lord. And it's all about obeying him and fearing him and doing it out of respect. Not necessarily even out of respect for your boss, but doing it out of respect for the Lord. Verse 23, he broadens the scope. Don't just obey in all things that you're commanded at work. He says, verse 23, whatever you do. And it's sort of like chapter 3 and verse 17. I said we were going to finish this chapter. I got to speed up here. Whatever you do, doesn't matter. And everything that's included in it, do it heartily. You do it with all your heart. Why? Because you're doing it for your boss? Look at these words. You do it with all your heart as to the Lord. When you go to work tomorrow, when you go to work tomorrow, when you have a task given to you, it might be easy to grumble. It might be easy to slack off. It might be easy to say, well, that's not important. God says to us, you go and do this, and whatever you do and whatever you're called upon to do, you do it heartily, not as to men, not to show off to your boss. You do it as if you're doing it for the Lord, because you are. Your relationship with the Lord will be affected by your relationship with other men. We almost finished chapter 3. We got tied up on the parent thing. That's where we lost our time, right? We got tied up on the kids. Wouldn't you know it? It was the kids that got us off track. Wouldn't that be the case? All right. See you next week.